Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is Citadel Group against Washington Regional Medical, 1131-24. Mr. Anderson.
May it please the Court, I'm John Anderson for the appellant, Citadel Group Limited. As this case comes before the Court, Your Honor, I believe the most salient fact is the statement or admission in Washington Regional's counterclaim that they had a legally enforceable contract whereby the parties mutually agreed to be obligated to one another.
But a contract for what?
The contract for development of a medical office building in Arkansas.
Well, see, that's what you say, but they agree they have a contract, but they see the contract that was entered into is of lesser scope than you do, so maybe you could address that.
That was my next point, Your Honor. In fact, what's salient about this case is usually in these cases the parties differ as to whether there was a contract. Here there's no doubt that there was one. And yet both Washington Regional and the district court state, first Washington Regional, whatever agreement the parties reached or whatever the scope of the parties' preliminary agreement, those are statements out of their response brief. And even the district court said, whatever the scope of the agreement. So we have both Washington Regional and the district court in their own minds raising a question as to what was the scope of the agreement. And I think that just as an opening point under the facts and the standard for summary judgment, where both parties like that say there's a question of fact as to what even the agreement is, summary judgment was inappropriately entered.
Why do you say that?
I was just going to say the text of the authorization to proceed explicitly outlines who will pay if the leases are not executed. Why would that language be necessary if the authorization document was creating a lease agreement? I mean, when you look at the specific language, there's no real agreement.
I think you have
on
to,
that.
Sorry, Your Honor. I think you have to read that, though, in the context of the statement by both the district court at page 5 of its opinion and Washington Regional that there was a legally enforceable contract mutually agreed to by the parties and binding on them.
But and you seem to think that it's impossible that there would be a series of contracts, like a contract for phase one and another contract for phase two if phase one is successfully completed. I don't see why parties couldn't structure a business deal that way.
They could, but here they didn't.
What's the language that Judge Williams read mean then?
But I think when you read that language in the context of what had happened preceding the signing of the authorization and what happened afterwards, it is true that there was an agreement.
Well, then what does it mean? What does this sort of walk-away provision mean?
That's precisely my point. It means, as in any real estate deal and as in the case here, at the top of the leasing term sheet there was a statement that it's subject to change for financing contingencies. And the way this was going to work would be there would be a letter of credit backing the commercial paper issued to finance the transaction. So it involved a third-party lender, a party that neither Washington Regional nor Citadel controls. And that is a not unusual contingency in any real estate-related transaction.
It's not unusual, but it's usually stated to be a financing contingency. And here, the district court did what it needs to do. It read the agreement to see if the agreement could be construed rationally or whether there was any question of fact. I can't imagine what that language would mean if it didn't mean that this is just a phase one agreement.
Well, it's spoken in terms of, it doesn't like give one party an out or anything else. It's a, like an abstractly phrased clause. Does not execute or the project is not ultimately developed.
What's abstract about does not execute?
Well, it almost speaks as if there is an agreement already and they don't sign the final documents. The terms of the lease are very clearly set by the time they signed. There's only the three requirements for a lease, namely the size of the building and the rent and the term. And those were set as of September 15th when the authorization was signed.
They weren't set. I mean, they were just a plethora of on certain things other than this initial email that you guys sent with the attachment.
No, I think the terms were set by the leasing term sheet, and the proof of it is their July 19th board minutes. In their July 19th board minutes, they go to their board and say that the lease rates offered by Citadel are significantly less than the next lowest bidder, RFI. And they have this document in their minutes, which calculates the lease rates.
You place great weight on that, but I wasn't so persuaded that that was anything but a, you know, here's an example, but it doesn't necessarily mean there's an agreement. It means that it's not completely devoid of numbers.
I think it comes back to what was the agreement, and here the agreement was a set cap rate that would apply to the cost of the building as Washington Regional determined.
Well, let me cut to the chase here. I mean, you, as far as I know, or at least as far as this record seems to indicate, have received the money that you spent. In other words, there's no unjust enrichment issue here. You're trying to get your estimated future profits from this deal. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, so you're not out anything. You did the development stage. You hired the architects. You hired the engineers. You did whatever it was you did. And that is not what's before us.
Correct.
What's before us is your right for something that, you know, at least they argue never materialized, which was the final agreement.
We argue it did materialize because the unique structure of this was set up to allow them to decide what they wanted. If they wanted a marble lobby versus ceramic tile, they could choose. It would affect.
What if they said they wanted a one-room log cabin? Would that be it?
Well, I think under Sonnenblick, the Seventh Circuit decision, they are bound to pick something within the realm of reasonableness in terms of what they wanted.
It sounds like you think they gave you a blank check by entering into some early development agreement.
It's not
where
that they
nothing was nailed down, not the size, not the percentage of medical offices, outpatient surgical center, et cetera, not the finish, not anything. There were just a lot of what-ifs floating around.
The size was set at 30,000 square feet in their initial RFP, and that was a size that was about the maximum that could be put on this lot. As shown by the May 06 board meeting minutes, they took our last set of numbers, which set the rent per square foot and the size of the building at 31,935 square feet.
No, I remember those numbers. So you think that by signing this initial thing to start the development, it didn't matter if your original estimate of $5 million was right or $6.2 million was right or $8.5 million or $14 million. They just had to pay you whatever it is you decided to have them pay you.
Designed to give them the flexibility to decide exactly what they wanted in terms of what type of space and how it was finished out.
Now, the document that lays out the $5 million and it's entitled the preliminary term sheet, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what are we to take preliminary to mean?
It's preliminary in that within a set formula, the parties could sit down and WRMC could decide what it wanted in the building and decide what quality of building it wanted. And then when those items were decided, a cost would be set. The building would be about 30,000 square feet. Maybe they could figure out how to make it a little larger, which they apparently did, and they would have a set rent. It made it easy for them to decide. Like I mentioned, do they want a marble lobby or a linoleum tile? They could immediately judge what the cost of that extra item would be in terms of their rent per square foot.
We know that this is your position because you've argued it. What about cases like PFT Roberson reflecting Illinois law? Illinois is averse to enforcing tentative agreements that are expressly contingent on the signing of final agreements. When we take that language that we don't seem to agree about in the exchanges into account.
Well, then there's Haslam and Dawson of this court.
Doesn't speak for Illinois.
But it's interpreting Illinois and applying it in the same context.
I think those cases are distinguishable anyway.
I think that in PFT especially, there were different facts in terms that the email specifically said that there will be documents we contain more of the legal details that are necessary for each of us to review and finalize. That's not the case here. These documents can be read in terms of that set formula, which for a development agreement makes sense for a party as Washington Regional so they could decide exactly what they wanted. As this went, at the time this was signed, they had not yet decided exactly the type of building they wanted. And this gave them the flexibility to do that and immediately determine the cost of doing so.
But in Dawson, the formula was a much more straightforward, pretty mechanical. Here, it's very hard to know how these variables would have worked out. Even you've agreed that there were many of them.
No, actually, there's very few. It's just the building they wanted. Once you have the cost, you have the cap rate and the size of the building, and it gives you your rent per square foot. It's a very simple arithmetical calculation.
You ever built a house? I mean, you could say the building you wanted is a house, but most people who've been through the building process find that it's a rather complex matter. Which contractor are you going to use for this, for that? How big, quality of things? Quality.
Here there'd be one party, and the issue is what did they decide they wanted? And what would reduce the complexity here is they would know the cost of it by applying the simple formula over any design they wanted. You know, how do they specify the space? What did they want in it? It gave them the flexibility to decide how they wanted this building constructed. For example, it started out with an ambulatory surgery center. That's obviously more expensive space. As the project was refined, they dropped that and decided they didn't need it and replaced it with regular office space, which is less expensive to build. It gave them the flexibility to do so.
I don't disagree with that. The question is, did they marry you with the first exchange of emails? That's really the fundamental question in this case. What was the contract between the parties that existed?
Well, we have Bradley's testimony that 5 days after he signed the authorization, he went and he told the board that you'll have a building, will start construction in March and April 2006. That's not the testimony of someone who didn't sign something that was going to be binding going forward.
Couldn't that be seen as the testimony? Besides, I mean, you're assuming we get into parole evidence here, of course, so let's put that out on the table now. But why isn't that just the testimony of an optimistic business person?
It also could be read as the testimony of someone who had signed a binding agreement and expected to begin construction at that time. We have Hutchinson's testimony that she did not have the intent that they could just back out of this deal as they did.
Why does all this testimony prevail over the words of the contract?
I think because you have here a situation where both the district court and Washington Regional say whatever the scope of the agreement is. And when there's a question about what the scope of the agreement is, that's under the variable annuity case of this court in 1998, a question of fact, which is why we believe summary judgment was improperly entered here. And even if the court finds that summary judgment was properly entered, there's still the issue of count three, the negotiation for good faith.
Where was the duty of good faith? From what in the agreement did the duty of good faith spring?
From the fact that the parties signed what the wording of the authorization even states is a comprehensive development agreement.
You seem to be confusing this duty of good faith with a covenant of fair dealing, which isn't an independent right of action.
I agree, Your Honor. It's not a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. It's a duty to negotiate in good faith, which the court...
Would you have to tie that to language in the agreement? Where did it come from?
In Milex, they just simply stated that they would negotiate a price. In Apothecarius, it would be that they would negotiate on a loan commitment. And that's all that was needed there for the court to find that there was such a duty. Here,
now, if you were to prevail, people would be very reluctant to proceed in a phased manner. I think they'd be afraid that they had signed on to more than they meant.
I think that they would be likely to sign on to an agreement of this nature where it gave them the flexibility to do what they hadn't yet decided on in terms of developing a property.
Okay.
If I may save the rest of my time. Thank you, Anna.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Good May it please the Court, my name is Mike Tomlinson, and I represent the appellee in this case, Washington Regional Medical Center. I think the Court's questions here have hit it right on the head, just as the District Court has hit it right on the head. The context of the statement that Citadel is trying to take out of that Citadel is making, that we agree that there's a binding agreement, has nothing to do with what's before this Court. What has to do with what's before this Court is what the contract was not. The contract, based on the plain language that you've identified already, was not one that involved set leases and lease terms. The contract did not contain the requirements of set leases and lease terms. It's important to understand the context, which I know you've seen from reading the briefs, in which this preliminary leasing term sheet came up. It was part of an original estimate, budget estimate, that Washington Regional received back from Citadel. 3 months later, the authorization letter, the letter with the authorization at the end of it, came.
So there are actually two sets of leases, right? There's the ground lease that WRMC was going to give to Citadel, and then Citadel was going to lease back through a separate set of leases, the finished space?
That's correct. Washington Regional was going to lease it back from Citadel, yes.
Right, they'd be the lessee. That's what I meant.
And what happened over time was, because the Washington Regional did not know what the mix of services would be in the building, because they didn't know exactly what the build-out in the building would be or the size of the building at the time that this contract was signed, that changed too. There became a different mix. As Mr. Anderson alluded to, there was no longer going to be an ambulatory surgery center. That wasn't decided until March of 2006. We can see by looking at the plain language and of the authorization and the plain language of the preliminary leasing term sheet that there simply was no intent to be bound by the parties here.
So at what point, in your view, would that kind of intent to be bound have been manifest? What document had to exist, or what was the next step?
Well, the next step in this particular case would have been executing actual ground and space leases, which is why the parties went ahead and continued to negotiate over those. They exchanged drafts all the way up until April of 2006 of these leases.
Would there have been even more agreements after that?
There could have been, depending on – there could have been after – you mean after April 2006?
Well, suppose the ground lease had been signed. Would that have been enough to trigger Citadel's right to go forward with building to your specifications? Would that have been part – I mean, at least in my simplistic mind, it seems to be the right to use certain land. It doesn't necessarily have to include the right to build in any particular way on that land.
Right. At a minimum, a ground lease would have had to have been signed before construction could have started.
But then do you think there would have been even more agreements specifying how the construction was to proceed?
Well, as Your Honor pointed out, and as Mr. Barwig, the CEO of Citadel, testified, construction and development is a fluid process. There could have been costs that changed. There was a final project cost that there would have been that the parties probably would have arrived at some point. They hadn't arrived at it yet here, but once that project cost was set, I think Washington Regional would have thought that at that point we can go ahead and execute some type of space leases. But we didn't get to that point in this case because we were at the choosing of the developer stage, and there's salient language that really hasn't been talked about here today that I'd like to point out to the Court. If you look at the preliminary leasing term sheet first, which is at Appendix G, project development is defined here. It says includes construction costs, tenant finishes, professional fees, financing costs, and other soft costs. That's stating what the costs are going to be, what type of costs are going to be incurred during project development. That is, coming up with the project that will ultimately be the building that will be built. So there was that's. And then if you tie that back over to the authorization to proceed at Appendix F, Washington Regional Medical Center authorizes Citadel Group Limited to proceed with project development. Okay? So it was authorizing Citadel to go forward with starting to gather the cost estimates and the budget for then eventually building the building. It had nothing to do with leases and lease terms. If those were going to be agreed upon, as the last sentence of the authorization unambiguously states, there would have been an agreement on those at some later time. That didn't happen. In fact, the testimony, the complete testimony in this case shows that even representatives of Citadel knew that the parties were going to continue to negotiate over leases and lease terms as things went forward. The cost of raw materials, as Citadel's own CEO testified, if we want to talk, address the formula here for a second, the cost of raw materials, cost of labor, interest rate changes, all of those could have changed the total project cost, which was, as the district court identified, was the key input into the supposed formula. Washington Regional doesn't concede that there was a formula provided to them. I think it's pretty common sense to most people that if you build a higher level building, there's a lease rate that's going to be higher. I know for a fact that that's what Washington Regional understood in this case, but you don't have to take it from me because we have testimony from Washington Regional's CEO about what the authorization authorized Citadel to do. At docket number 125, paragraph 35, in the exhibits cited therein, Bill Bradley, Washington Regional CEO, testified that the authorization permitted the parties to, quote, move forward with the concept we'd all come up with and see if we could get the details worked out. He also stated that he wasn't interested in proposed lease terms because there was a lot still undefined, and the final terms of the ground and space leases would depend on unknown factors. It's the same testimony you would hear from Citadel CEO. And then we couple that testimony and the back to the preliminary leasing term sheet and the broad disclaimer at the top. Even if this is part of the party's agreement, which Washington Regional has never conceded, this, even if this preliminary leasing term sheet was incorporated into the development letter that Citadel sent, the top of this shows that even the disclaimer at the top of this shows that even Citadel never intended to be bound by the terms on this term sheet. You aptly pointed out that this is not a limited disclaimer. It's not a financing contingency disclaimer. Citadel has continually ignored that throughout this entire litigation and again here in this court. This is a much broader disclaimer, meaning that keeps either party from being bound to the terms of this term sheet.
So in count one, you, I guess that part's all resolved. But I'm correct, am I not, that WRMC did use the engineering and architectural plans that Citadel had arranged for?
Well, they used the same architects and engineers. They built upon whatever had been done before to actually finalize the building. That is correct. They did that almost a year after terminating the relationship with Citadel. And I think that's an important point to realize, too. And it is in the record cited to this court. Citadel, after the termination of the relationship with Citadel, Washington Regional didn't just pick up the architects and engineers and say, let's go, we're going to build this building without them. What happened was there was a period of time during which they decided exactly what they were going to do in with respect to building this building, if it was going to go forward or not.
Why does that make it any better? I mean, you know, if Washington Regional was going to go ahead on its own without Citadel, why was it entitled to use the same architects and engineers? Sort of free ride on Citadel's efforts.
Well, it's important to understand that it wasn't just Citadel's efforts. Citadel has claimed that it's its work product. But Citadel has also admitted in deposition testimony that Washington Regional had input into that work product. They can't stand up here in front of this court and say that it was all up to Washington Regional, it was all up to Washington Regional, and then try to claim that, but all the work product was ours. It's just,
well, did you interview other architects or... Did you interview anybody else in the interim, other construction contractors, to compare costs or anything like that? Or was it just the delay in deciding whether you were going to do it yourselves or not? That's what I understood the delay.
Right. I'm not entirely sure. My understanding is at least with respect to the construction firms, there were interviews with other people.
Is that in the record?
I don't believe so. Not the record before this court. With respect to the authorization, we see that if you look at the circumstances and the facts and circumstances surrounding the negotiations and even the parties' actions afterwards, which you have to do in determining whether the parties intended to be bound if you get beyond the plain language, we see that the parties continue to negotiate leases and lease terms after the authorization was set. If they continue to negotiate leases and lease terms, how can there have been set lease terms? It doesn't make any sense. There's no genuine issue of material fact as to that issue. I would like to also address the fact that after the authorization was signed, there was a March 21st, 2006 email from Adam Lynch to Tammy Hutchison, which was cited in the record. That's at docket number 125-3 at pages 27 to 29, in which Mr. Lynch sent an email. Now, this is more than 6 months after the parties had supposedly agreed on lease terms, according to Citadel.
Is this the one that she responds, wow, to?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And even in that, they're trying to explain how they calculated lease rates. They term even the new lease rates preliminary lease rates.
And she says you've got to come way down.
Eventually, she comes back and says you've got to come down, yes.
Yeah.
Moving on to, real briefly to the breach of the duty to negotiate in good faith, I think there's a separate reason that this panel can affirm on that basis, since it's cited in the briefs, is that they never pled this. They never pled a duty to negotiate in good faith. It's not in the amended complaint. But the district court went ahead and analyzed it as such because Citadel started making certain arguments in that vein.
Once the district court has addressed the point, it seems a little hyper-technical for us not to look at it.
And I agree with that. I think the district court's opinion was directly on point with this issue. There was no language within the agreements giving rise to a duty to breach or a duty to negotiate in good faith, and even if it had arisen, Washington Regional didn't breach it. There was testimony that the email that we just spoke about from Tammy Hutchison saying they needed fair market value lease rates, their own Citadel's own CEO testified that that was not a new term being introduced into the transaction. Addressing the May 16th board minutes, I'm not understanding the significance of those board meetings when Citadel gave Washington Regional the one side of the column and Washington Regional plugged those numbers into its PowerPoint presentation, and then they came up with what they expected to be able to come up with, or what they expect to be able to save in terms of lease rate if they did it on their own using local financing, which was different from the type of financing that Citadel was going to use. Washington Regional didn't use the formula that Citadel came up with and is now advocating in preparing its side of the equation.
I mean, it's one thing to understand Citadel's numbers, which could be either seen as a concluded contract, as they say, or it could be seen as your comprehension, at least, of the outlines of the offer on the table. Quite another thing to come to the decision whether there has been an agreement on that point or whether you're still thinking about it, if you will, whether it's still under negotiation. So they're just two ways of looking.
Correct. I agree with that point, obviously. And I also, at that same time in May of 2006, there were other contingencies that were unresolved that were pointed out in the record, such as the construction monitor firm had drainage concerns about the drainage on the property. There was a loan-to-value issue that Fifth Third Bank raised regarding whether this property could appraise out properly and whether there would have to be a Regulation H exception applied for. There were other things that were unresolved here.
But there is today a facility standing on that piece of land, right?
That's correct. And it was after Citadel found out about that they first amended their complaint to include this count two in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For the reasons I've just set forth, I think this court should affirm the district court's decision granting summary judgment to Washington Regional with respect to count two, and should affirm the district court's decision to dismiss with prejudice count three. The court, in two separate opinions, did a thorough analysis of both of these issues and got it right here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Anderson? I think you have about a minute to do that.
The counsel referred to the fact that there were numerous other agreements. That's not true. There was just going to be the lease, the terms of which were set, and it was our job to deliver the building. He referred to statements about construction costs, tenant finishes, and project development. We don't dispute that. The parties were to refine what this building was within the context of that set formula. He also referred to the April 2006 memo about a fair market value. Hutchison testified fair market value was 22 to 25 for a rental rate, and their board minutes show that we had given them $2,366 per square foot, right in the middle of what she said was a fair market value. The board minutes are very significant. because they show that the terms with us were set and were definite. They were not unknown. And so we would ask the court to reverse the district court's ruling on summary judgment and to reverse the dismissal of count three. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.